Oh, yes,
Blog Talk Radio.
From the far reaches of the known universe, we are proud to present Brother Harold Muhammad, soldier, scientist, scholar. Blog Talk Radio's finest, not so mad science, on Black Hole Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to tonight's edition of Not So Mad Science here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, coming to you live from the city of Detroit, just because Motown went to L.A. does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. We have an interesting program this evening, heavy into the sciences, but I do not want you to feel as if it's going to be overwhelming. It will not be, I promise. I want to talk to you about three subjects tonight. One, Mr. Stephen Hawking, the deceased astrophysicist, who in his last major paper was looking for extraterrestrial life. Number two, the United States government, in its infinite wisdom, have decided to fund another project to find the elusive, the enigmatic dark matter, dark energy, these things which comprise over 90% of the universe, yet seems to be elusive and invisible to its scientific searchers. And three, and more significantly, the enigmatic planet Platoon, in the ancient language, and Pluto, in the ignorance of Proto-European societies. These are the Greeks, the Romans, and the English. But we will begin tonight's program with Mr. Stephen Hawking. Why was Mr. Hawking looking for alien life when he died? And why was it so significant that his search for alien life gave such a boost to those who are engaged in that pursuit? So, to that end, the time is now 6:33 p.m., and I'm going to ask my engineer to give me a small piece of music while we get prepared for tonight's program. So, if my engineer is able, would you please play something short, up-tempo, and significant as we get ourselves ready to engage in tonight's discussion. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. It appears that my engineer is not able to make things happen. Therefore, let's dive right into it with Mr. Stephen Hawking. And wow, am I really intrigued by what I'm seeing here. My computer has decided to have renal failure, and I can't seem to see anything that I took notes on the screen. But as with any good student who has aspirations and hopes of being a good teacher someday, you must always be prepared to go from what you've read and retained in your thought processes and not specifically what you have written down. So, let's head off what I have in my head. Mr. Stephen Hawking, now deceased, was considered to be and known to be one of the preeminent astrophysicists, theoretical physicists in the world. His imagery of being severely disabled physically did not impact on his ability to process thought. It did not delay his ability or impede his ability to communicate beyond what he could say verbally to what could be produced electronically via his thinking into a device which allowed him to then have speech. In my opinion, he was the preeminent poster child for not being held back because of one's disability. That being said, his thinking capacity took him into the realm of and the theoretical world of what is or is not a black hole. It took him into the processes of what is or is not to be considered a rational idea with regard to planetary bodies and or space or the fabric of space itself. Such that his opinion carried great weight. So, before his death this past March, Mr. Stephen Hawking announced a $100 million project to find intelligent life among the stars. This is where he and I've challenged him via this program many, 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 many times. That challenge went unanswered. One of the items that I challenged him on is that you're looking out there for the intelligent life from among the stars when that intelligent life stands right here looking at you in the face. Is there life on the other planets? Absolutely yes. What is the nature and the construct of that life? That is something that I had hoped to discuss with him at length and give him the proofs from my perspective. But since he announced the $100 million project to find intelligent life among the stars, that push will redouble thanks to new technology that will allow astronomers to scan the galaxy like they've never scanned it before. On Monday, the Breakthrough Listen Project. I'm going to say that one more time. This past Monday, the Breakthrough Listen Project announced the launch of an expanded survey of stars in the Milky Way galaxy made possible by a multi-beam receiver installed on Australia's Parkes Radio Telescope. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg and Russian inventor Yuri Milner and Mr. Hawking debuted the Breakthrough Listen Project in 2015 to collect massive amounts of deep space data and make it public in an effort to identify signals pointing to alien life. It is my opinion that in truth, they're really looking for something else, but that's the subject of another program. But let's take it at its word's sake. The new receiver will rely on 13 beams to scan a huge swath of space. Once again, I'm reminded of a line from the movie starring Bruce Willis, where he and his team are a team of highly skilled miners who must fly up in the space shuttle to an asteroid to drill, to blow the asteroid up so that it doesn't impact the Earth. And when the head of NASA is asked by the president why they did not see the asteroid coming, it was Billy Bob Thornton's character, who is the mission director of NASA, who replied, "Well, Mr. President, it's really a big-ass sky." To that end, these 13 beams are designed to scan a huge swath of space. Quickly pulling data, researchers will analyze for signals that have indications of artificial origin, according to the project's announcement. But why would the life which is to be found or looked for in that really big ass sky, why would you consider it to be artificial? Would it not be natural? But there's something going on here. So I'm going to ask your indulgence for a few moments while I look into this small problem that I have taking place around me. So I'm going to hit you with a little bit of the Isley Brothers and, better yet, let's make that George Benson and Masquerade. I'll be right back.
Looking for words to say. searching but not finding, understanding anywhere. We're all in a masquerade. Both afraid to say we're just too far away from being close together from the start. We tried to talk it over, but the words got in the way.
Once again, this is Not So Mad Science, and I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. It appears that one of my little guys is a little ill at the moment, but he will persevere. Let's get back at it. We're talking about Mr. Stephen Hawking, the deceased and world-renowned theoretical physicist, and his announcement of the $100 million project to search for intelligent life amongst the stars. With these new capabilities, and I'm quoting Mr. Danny Price of the Breakthroughs Parks Project scientist from the University of California, Berkeley. And he said in a statement, with these new capabilities, we are scanning our galaxy in unprecedented detail. He says, by trawling through these huge data sets for signatures of technological civilizations, we hope to uncover evidence that our planet, among the hundreds of billions in our galaxy, is not the only one where intelligent life has arisen. Again, I have great disagreement with the language used for the search for intelligent life. It gives an implication that the only life that is worthy of being sought after, look for, or engage with, as if this is some Star Trek, Star Wars, Orwellian type of environment, is that life of a planet where there's only horses. Is that not considered life? Because it does not communicate in a fashion of which you're accustomed? If it was a planet filled with only avian life, birds, would that life not be considered viable enough to warrant your attention or interaction with it? Because it does not communicate with you in a manner and a fashion that you find to be at your level. What if it was only life that could be considered to be simian, monkeys in nature? Would that not be considered intelligent enough for you to talk to? Because it seems that the scientists of today spend a lot of time studying the communal habits of simian life, teaching it to hand sign so that it can have a means of communication, since it apparently lacks the oral capacity to talk. But I've heard it told with respect to equestrian life, the only thing limiting a horse's ability to speak, since it does have the intelligence to communicate and to verbalize its feeling, is the structure of its oral cavity, that it does possess the ability to speak, just that its mouth structure is not conducive for one to have a conversation. I'm sorry, Mr. Ed, you don't talk. But you are an intelligent animal, and you do have the capacity to speak. So, to say that the search for life must be limited to a technologically evolved society is only worth your time is grossly inaccurate and morally incorrect. Life is life. For as your science says, we started off with life on this planet from a microbial bacterial form that evolved up into its present stage of human form now. So would such life possibly be found someplace else that needs the time to evolve? So to trawl through these huge data sets for signatures of a technological civilization is very short-sighted and foolish, in my opinion. Intelligent life does exist, and it is not limited to this blue marble we call the Earth. This is Not So Mad Science. I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. And that closes out this particular discussion of Mr. Stephen Hawking and the $100 million project to be used to scan the stars in a search for extraterrestrial life. Jumping to our next subject, the U.S. will fund another project to find that which should be easy to see, dark matter. For when you look at anything, should it not be far easier to see that which is 90% of an object as opposed to being only able to find and account for 10 to 15% of something? So the U.S. government will fund another super sensitive and exorbitantly expensive dark matter experiment. Ryan F. Mandelbaum, in his writing for Physics, the journal, says, in his paper, the U.S. Department of Energy will fund the most sensitive search yet for theorized dark matter particles. Well, my dear friend, dark matter is not a theory. It's quite real. And it truly is the most substantive material in existence, as well as the dark energy which powers that dark material. You can't see it because you're looking in the wrong place. But with respect to the government's funding in its search for that which is right in front of its face, they will pay for a project that will sit over a mile underground in a former nickel mine near the Canadian city of Sudbury. The proposed super cryogenic dark matter search at Snow Lab, or Super CDMS Snowland would be a detector held at near absolute zero. For those who do not know what absolute zero is, on the Kelvin scale, I'm going to share with you what it is in Fahrenheit, because that is a terminology that you're familiar with. It's 80 degrees Fahrenheit outside. Hey, it's hot. Well, minus 495 degrees Fahrenheit is absolute zero Kelvin. It is a temperature at which there is no molecular or atomic movement. The nature and structure of an atom ceases to rotate. It is the nature where the bond between substructures in an atom, the nucleus, will no longer stay the nucleus. The electrons will no longer circumnavigate in that gaseous cloud around that nucleus. There's nothing to hold it together. Absolute zero. So, the proposed super cryogenic dark matter search at Snow Lab, or the Super CDMS Snow Lab, would be a detector held at near absolute zero that would be sensitive enough to detect the elusive dark matter with silicon and germanium atoms. It joins a long line of other experiments hunting for weakly interacting massive particles, or WIMPs, the most popular dark matter material or particle candidate. But what is popular is not necessarily what is so. Throughout the universe, there exist hints of unaccounted for mass. Galaxies rotate too quickly at their edges, and the seemingly empty regions beside clusters of colliding galaxies warp the shape of space around them as if there were stuff there. Popular solution to solve this mystery are WIMPs, particles that interact too weakly with regular matter to be detected by our instruments, our telescopes, or any other observing equipment. Super CDMS Snow Lab is the next iteration of the CDMS experiment, currently located deep in the Soudan mine in Minnesota. Building these experiments in deep mines serves to eliminate potential sources of outside noise, mainly cosmic rays from outer space. Like its predecessor, the Super CDMS holds silicon and germanium crystals at -459.6 degrees Fahrenheit, nearly absolute zero. A passing weakly interacting dark matter particle from space would create vibrations and electrons through the medium, like a pebble dropping into super still water. Now, if you know anything about dark matter, and most of us don't, that would sound familiar. The current most sensitive experiment, the NEON, X-E-N-O-N, operates on a similar principle, except it measures emitted light particles and electrons instead of vibrations. It's located deep in an Italian mountain. The Lux Zeppelin, or the LZ, operates on a similar design, and it's situated at a retrofitted mine in South Dakota. Scientists from those collaborations are excited about the competition. Super CDMS will look through a different mass range with a different sensitivity. And in some sense, it's a whole new area, according to Bob Jacobson, the Lux Zeppelin scientist at the University of California, Berkeley. But he warned this: results aren't around the corner. The experiment won't begin taking results until the early 2020s, and it won't be cheap. The Department of Energy will contribute $19 million. The National Science Foundation will contribute $12 million. And the Canada Foundation for Innovation will contribute $3 million. Dear friends, the hunt for dark matter continues, and scientists will keep on hunting, and hunt they will. They're sure that WIMPs aren't the answer. And I agree. All of us know what dark matter is. All of us know where dark matter is generated from. And we know why it is. Only we won't look there. What is the most powerful force in nature? Look there, and you'll find dark matter. And look what contains that power, and you will find dark energy. I could tell you, but I won't, because that's the subject, once again, for another day. This is Not So Mad Science. I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We are going to take another very, very, very short and uninterrupted break. And we're going to get into the meat of tonight's program. We're going to be discussing Platoon, or Pluto. Some would ask, why do you keep saying Platoon when the name of the place is Pluto? I'll explain that when we come back. Once again, it seems that our program is a little non-responsive with us tonight. But, stated before, any good student with designs and hopes of being a good teacher remains prepared to go from what they've studied and not what they've written down, and allow God to take control of that voice. Well, God, here I am. Take me. I don't mind shutting up to let the world hear you. So, Platoon, Pluto, before the Greeks and Romans issued forth in their idiom of language the name Pluto, after the Lord of the Underworld in Greek and Roman mythology, what was that body, that interstellar body, within the framework of our solar system? What was it called? And who called it that? Was the existence or the understanding and knowledge of that planet Pluto limited to the sightings of the Greeks and or Romans? Or were they taught about it? It would seem, with just a little bit of study, a little bit of research, that the planet Pluto had a name prior to the coming of the Greeks and Romans and their mythology of the god of the underworld, Pluto. No, I don't mean Pluto the dog from Walt Disney. I mean Pluto, the mythological god of the underworld, the afterlife. Why they named what they call that icy body, which is, in fact and truthfully, the ninth planet of our solar system, the Sol system. Sol, S-O-L, meaning sun system, was known about millennia before the societies of the Greeks and Romans even evolved. In the records of Al-Azhar University in Egypt, in the records of the university at Timbuktu, in the records of the University of Memphis, not Memphis, Tennessee, but Memphis, part of what you would call the Middle East. No, Memphis was not a Greek or Roman state. Memphis was a city-state of Arabian and or Egyptian culture. In the libraries of Memphis, the libraries of Timbuktu, the libraries of Al-Azhar University, was the record of the planetary body Platoon, which sat at the farthest edge of the solar system, of the Sol solar system. Platon or Platon. Platoon. In the idiom of the old language, but with the coming of the Greeks and Romans, as that great scholar and historian wrote, George G.M. James, in his book, Stolen Legacy, they stole a culture and an understanding and a wisdom that was not their own, and they misinterpreted it. And in their misinterpretation, they also misunderstood the writing. And their misunderstanding, they named it for their mythology. to hide the fact that they were taught about it, and it was known about for millennia before they even existed, while they were still in the caves and hillsides of Europe. Platoon. Why was it important to downgrade the planet Pluto from a planet to a planetoid? Was there truly an astronomical need for this downgrading, or was there a psychosocial need which had a relationship to a teaching which taught that on the discovery of the Western modern world of the planet Pluto in 1914, that one would come who would be the Prince of Peace, the Lord of Lords, the King of Kings, the Mighty God, would show himself to the world, would introduce himself with this discovery, or in this case, the rediscovery of that which was already found, of the ninth system, the ninth planet in the solar system. I use that language to indicate this. The Sol system, the solar system in which we live, is reflective of the systems and the relationship that we have to the system that we live in. What do you mean, Mr. Muhammad? How do you know? Well, I'm glad you asked. Even if it's me asking the question, because I'm going to ask the question you would ask. How do you know? What do you know, and why do you know it? Well, the human body has 11 major organs, but it has 9 distinct systems which reflect the 9 systems or bodies in our solar system. Well, what are those 9 systems? Circulatory, respiratory, digestive, nervous, endocrine, immune, integumentary, and skeletal. Now, wait a minute. Someone would ask, integumentary, what the hell is that? This is not so mad science, and this is what we get into. We make the seemingly difficult, very simple. The integumentary system is your skin. It is the largest organ and system in the body. Yes. The integumentary system. It is integral to hold everything in. So, the integumentary system comprises the skin and its appendages, acting to protect the body from various kinds of damage, the loss of water, abrasions, intrusions from sickness and bacteria. That is the integumentary system. That system also includes your hair and your fingernails. That is the your toenails as well. So for those who don't recall that, your fingernails and your toenails are the same stuff. That's the integumentary system. It is that protective layer on the exterior of the epidermis and dermis that functioned as a barrier to the outside world. So now we know what the integumentary system is. We can get back to our subject. Platoon, Pluto. The planet Pluto was supposedly discovered in 1914. It matched a scriptural prophecy hidden in the language of both Bible, Quran, and Torah, as well as in the language, the prophetic language of the Zend Avesta. That discovery marked the day or the announcement of a heavenly discovery would be the sign of he who is king would come into the world, make himself known. He made himself known by a new body. Until 1914, there was believed to be only 8 systems in the body. That body being the solar system. But there was an imbalance. The imbalance is that the body must reflect the outer body. The outer body is the solar system. With that announcement of the discovery of this new planet, which circumnavigated the sun in a precise and a rhythmic motion that could be calculated and depended upon to meet that cycle of time. Pluto was located in 1914. It was then discovered the relationship between the macro system of the solar system and the internal systems of the human body. The discovery. Those that understood were aware of the importance and the significance of the finding of Pluto, the 9 systems in the human body. They knew that he who was prophesied to be had come. It was a nexus where science and scripture met. The mathematics of it could not be ignored, nor could it be denied. The knowers knew the time. Thus, they knew what was needed to be done in that time. So, it was not until, the International Astronomical Union made a decision that they were going to drop Pluto and reduce its classification from a planet to a planetoid, thus hoping that those who study would get lost in the time track such that they would not recognize or understand that God was present in the world. See, when I said not so mad science, where we would take what was seemingly difficult to comprehend and to visualize and make it simple and understandable, you thought because I teach physics and chemistry and high math and other sciences that this was just going to be a straight-laced program. No. is the highest form of the sciences, because you must understand or have a running understanding of chemistry. You must have a running understanding of physics. You must have a running understanding of biology, anatomy, and all the other sciences in order to understand your relationship with the one who gave you life. And I'm not talking about your mother and father. They're the vessel by which your life was produced, but they're not the ones who gave you life. So, as we continue on this journey, let's take a look at why Pluto was supposedly dropped as a planet. We're going to take a look at the International Association and see what their motivations were scientifically, and gain some understanding. It was in, and I believe it was Forbes magazine, when it was first reported, that Pluto would no longer be classified as a planet by the International Association. Now, it's important to understand that the classification or misclassification of Pluto is relevant. And it's an article that was written by Ethan Siegel. And it wasn't Forbes magazine, it was Science, with the hashtag, whoa, science. So let's take a look in here. He says, you won't like the consequences of what it means to make Pluto a planet again. And this is what caught my eye. For those who are avid listeners to this program, I like to read, and I read a lot. I read as many publications that I can get my hands on, as many journals as I can locate and find with the limited resources that I have, and what I can't find, I hunt down via the free medium called the internet to find other things. And then I begin my search to decipher what is malarkey, cock-a-doodle-doo, and flat earth nonsense, and compare it to what I know to be the truth as taught to me by that master teacher, the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad. A truth that can only be verified, not theorized, nor can it be denied. Now, it was, and I stand corrected, not 1914, but its discovery in 1930. Pluto was heralded as the ninth planet in our solar system in 1930. Pluto was the first world ever discovered beyond the planet Neptune. And for nearly half a century, was the only world known beyond the last gas giant, Neptune. And for generation after generation after generation, school children learn the mnemonic device about their very educated mother just serving them nine pickles, with Pluto being the last one. that last lonely one out there becoming the favorite planet of so many. And after 76 years, now that number 76 is quite important once again in terms of its theological importance. We in the Nation of Islam have learned that the Creator God created himself over 76 to 78 trillion years ago. And it was 76 years later, from 1930, that astronomers, seemingly for no apparent reason, demoted Pluto to a dwarf planet status, placing it alongside large asteroids like Ceres and other worlds out there in the Kuiper Belt, reducing our solar system's planetary count to just 8 once again. Last year, a team of scientists put forth a new definition of a planet that would bring Pluto back into the fold. And that definition had been endorsed by Mr. Alan Stern and David Grinspoon, authors of a new book on the New Horizon mission and the planet Pluto. Now, here's what it would mean if the general public listened to them with regard to the discovery of the planet Pluto. And just for you to know, it was Clyde Tombaugh who is credited with the original images identifying Pluto in 1930, 76 years ago. The International Astronomical Union, the IAU, did something that no one had ever done before. And they gave their scientific definition to one of astronomy's oldest terms, planet. And the so-called old "I know it when I see it" definition had come under fire for a variety of reasons, including the growing number of what is called trans-Neptunian objects found in the Kuiper Belt and beyond. Now, I'm going to give an understanding of what the difference is and what a planet truly is with respect to our solar system and those objects found in the Kuiper Belt. Many objects out there were round, with enough gravity to pull themselves in what is considered a hydrostatic equilibrium. Some of them were even more massive than Pluto. And there were a growing number of worlds being discovered around stars other than our own. Were all of these new objects planets as well? Some of them? None of them? And what about Pluto? The definition they put forth would not only ruffle feathers and spark controversy, it would prove immediately to be insufficient. The IAU's definition, the International Astronomers Union, had just three statements. Their definition says, one, a planet had to be massive enough that its gravity would pull itself into a hydrostatic equilibrium. Round if it wasn't rotating, but a spheroidal shape if it was. Number two, A planet had to orbit a sun and no other object. Meaning the Earth could be a planet because it rotates the sun, but not the moon. And number three, it had to clear its orbit, meaning there could be no other comparable large masses at the same orbitable distance. Mars is a planet, but asteroids and Kuiper belt objects were all out. They're not officially. Under this definition, our solar system was down to 8 planets. Now, there are a couple of things wrong here, but I'm going to finish and then I'll explain what's wrong. For astronomers who study our own solar system, this would be fine if it was just limited to astronomy. For those astronomical purposes, these 8 planets have distinct properties that all other worlds don't. They are united by a similar common formation history. They influence the motion of the sun and other worlds more severely than any other world. They reflect more sunlight than any other worlds, and they dominate gravitationally their portion of the solar system. 8 planets, from many perspectives, is just the right number. That, by definition, is inherently wrong. If one is limited to the prevailing definitions that they provide. And therein lies the rub. But this definition that they provided was dissatisfying to 3 very different groups. Astronomers called exoplanet astronomers, galactic astronomers, and planetary scientists, of which I would consider myself to be one of those. Exoplanet astronomers have a very compelling argument. Why would a body orbiting our star, the sun, be classified as a planet, but the world around any other star couldn't be? It seemed like a tremendous oversight in 2006. As we have had over a decade of discovered exoplanets behind us at that point. The rationale given after the fact that was given by some was that there was no way to tell whether a planet had cleared its orbit or not from so far away. Really? Do you really expect other scientists to buy that hogwash? That may have been true in 2006. It wasn't, but I'm just giving the argument's sake, that may have been true in 2006. But 9 years later, UCLA professor Jean-Luc Margot being spelled M-A-R-G-O-T, changed the game by devising a universal planetary test that didn't require a spaceship. If you could learn the following 3 easy-to-measure parameters. 1, the mass of the planet. 2, its orbital distance or period around its parent star, and 3, the lifetime of the planetary system in question. This could be determined with better than 99% accuracy whether a body satisfies the three IAU criteria for being a planet. It gets more interesting. I'm going to interject something else in here. No, let's just wait. I'm going to hold that off. That it's a bomb. I'm going to hold it just for a few more minutes. Just a few more moments. Because perhaps you'll see the humor as I do. Quite clearly, the eight planets of our solar system would fit into that definition. And the asteroid and the Kuiper belt objects are out. Interestingly, though, if there were, and I repeat, if there were only the moon rather than the Earth-Moon system orbiting the sun, it would be right on the border between planet and non-planet. But then, for the galactic astronomers, what do you do for these things determined to be rogue planets? If you don't have a parent star to orbit at all, either because you were formed or born without one, or you were ejected from your home solar system, does that make you any less of a planet? It's about to get more interesting. Bear with me now. That is a tough question. Because in astronomy, as in real estate, location, location, location is almost everything. Mercury, if it were placed at the distance of Jupiter, would never clear its orbit and it wouldn't obtain planetary status. A world much smaller than Mercury could be a planet around a dwarf, a red dwarf star. While even the Earth would fail to be a planet if it were out in the Oort cloud somewhere. And yet, we call so many of these non-planetary worlds planets, but with a prefix. We have dwarf planets, rogue planets, and exoplanets. In the early stages, we have the term protoplanets and planetesimals. But at some level, aren't all of them plus more just still a planet? This argument gets taken to an extreme by some planetary scientists, as elucidated, expounded upon, and argued over by Stern and Grinspoon, who in yesterday's Washington Post, they contend that location should be ignored, and that if you're massive enough to pull yourself into hydrostatic equilibrium, again, a sphere if you aren't spinning, or a spheroid if you are, Congratulations, you're a planet. This would mean that if we looked at objects under 10,000 kilometers in diameter in our solar system, there wouldn't be two Mars and Mercury planets, but there would be 109 of them. The solar system would rise to 115 planets with 19 moons, one asteroid, and 87 objects beyond Neptune added to the current total of 8. And in the future, as we discover more objects in the Kuiper belt, the scattered disk, and even the Oort cloud, that number will rise further, perhaps into the thousands. I pray that you're seeing the pattern that I'm seeing as to why the IAU, in its effort to downgrade planet Pluto from planet to planetoid, all this sounds a little bit confusing, doesn't it? The writer also says, on one hand, there are advantages to the argument they make. When we talk about the geological, astrospheric, and geophysical properties of a world, we do, in fact, call them all planets. We call the field of study of these worlds planetary science. And when we talk about a world's oxygen content, crust, composition, or potential for habitability, we have no qualms calling these measurable quantities planetary properties. On Pluto alone, we've learned that it has clouds, it has weather, it has snow, mountains, valleys, geological layers, and likely even a subsurface ocean. It has 5 moons of its own. It rotates on its axis. It has cycles of day and night and seasons. If you ignored its astronomical location as the 9th body in the solar system, being the farthest out, you would call it a planet every time. But, or should I say, and yet, that's the other hand. You have to ignore all of astronomy to consider Pluto a planet. And therein lies the question that you need to ask yourself. Should an object's position in a solar system determine what a planet is or is not? Or should only the intrinsic properties of the world matter? What is the value of a person? Is it the amount of money they make? Or do you look at the content of their heart? The character of their actions and the quality of their words and thoughts put into action? Should we ignore completely the connection between planets and solar systems, stars, their formation, and the gravitational dance that has always fueled our knowledge and curiosity about them? The simple fact is that Pluto was not misclassified when it was first discovered. And it does have equal footing as the other 8 worlds. Why? because every planet in our solar system rotates in submission to the will of the light of the sun, which acts upon it at its axis and spins each at the terrific speed of 1,037 and a third miles per hour on its axis. How fast does Mercury rotate on its axis? 1,037 and a third miles per hour. How fast does Venus rotate on its axis? 1,037 and a third miles per hour. How fast does this big blue marble we call the Earth rotate on its axis? 1,037 and a third miles per hour. Mars, Venus, Jupiter, Neptune, Uranus, and even Pluto all rotate on its axis in submission to the light of the sun that strikes it at the angle to rotate it on its axis at the exact same rate of speed. All the planets submit to the will of the solar field emitted by the sun and its magnetic attraction on them. The moon does not spin on its axis. We see the same face every day. Ganymede and the other moons of Saturn. Correction. Jupiter. Do not rotate on their axis at the same rate of speed as the planet in which they are committed, which does rotate at 1,037 and a third miles per hour. What makes it a planet? It submits to and commits to the same laws of cause and effect as the other planets in its system. So, why did the International Astronomical Union, in its wisdom, attempt to downgrade Pluto from a planet to a planetoid? Item one, confusion. Because in confusion, there lies the plate and the salad of doubt. If you begin to doubt the evidence of you that you see, which was outlined in prophecy in all the major books of Scripture, that he who is Lord would present himself on the discovery of a new light in heaven, then you begin to doubt that God is in the world. This cannot be. And why should we not give great heed and consideration to the International Astronomers Union? The answer is in the name. And I'll give you a definition. The International Astronomers Union is not a legally binding body or authority. It is an association, a group of like-minded astronomers and other scientists who gave their interpretation and opinion on a subject matter and then thrust that opinion onto the world, but it carries no more weight than an opinion and not a definition that is sound. That is the weight that the opinion of the International Astronomers Union carries. The International Astronomers Union, once again, is an association of astronomers. They are not a legal authority. If you cater to their opinion, then you will accept their thought that Pluto is not a planet, but a planetoid. Guess what? They're not the only other authority or scientist who study planetary bodies, because even amongst their own union, there are those who disagree with the association's definition. There are other associations, and they cater to the wisdom that because each of the planets in the solar system all conform to a specific set of criteria in both their orbit, inclination, and angle, and rotational speed to the sun. And that is the binding requirement to define it as a planet, thus maintaining the integrity and sounding of the prophecy of the coming of God. July 4th, 1930. The Messiah to the Christians and the Mahdi to the Muslims. He who is the sun and the light, the S-O-N and the S-U-N. Now, there are a couple of things that need to be looked at. They're saying that the sun, light of the sun, does not reach Platoon. Au contraire, but it does. You're considering light to be the visual spectrum that you see, but light photons are that much more than the visual spectrum that your equipment can see. For the most powerful force in nature is neither atomic, bionic, muscular, combustible, is none of those things. The most powerful force in nature is thought, and it moves at a terrific speed, on average, of 24 billion miles per second. It is faster than the speed of light. But the light that extends from the sun to Pluto, the distance between photons is longer in wavelength than the shorter wavelength that hits the closer planets. It takes 8 minutes for the light of the sun to reach the Earth. But in that 8 minutes, it spins the Earth at 1,037 and a third miles per hour. I have not taken the time to calculate the time that it takes a photon of light to leave the sun and to reach Platoon. But I will do so, and I will bring that information to you as soon as I have done the math. But the wavelength, the distance between one photon to the next photon, the longer, still spins that planetary body at the same rate of speed of 1,037 and a third miles per hour. So all you astronomical buttheads out there who espouse that cockamamie doo-doo, shut the fud up. I didn't say it, I said fud. Stop that and stop adding confusion to the world when you know the truth. It has been written and said that on the coming of the Son of Man, he will give the beast an inkling and a peek into his mind before he eliminates him from existence completely. We are living in a time of the peak. Take heed, my dear friend, brothers and sisters. Take notice and keep the faith. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. And once again, and as always, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. And I damn sure going to say it again, just because Berry Gordy took Motown to L.A., Detroit has not lost its soul. Why? We are here. And here we stay. This is Mecca. And Mecca will rise once again. Keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith. And all willing, I'll see you next week.